Welcome to Rust Belt Science. I'm your host, Maggie Fink.
And I'm Shahir Risk.
How are you doing today, Shahir?
I'm doing great.
Good. We don't have a guest today, so it's just the two of us. We're going to talk about some fun things. But since we don't have a guest, I wanted to ask you, are you listening to, reading, watching anything interesting right now?
I watched a bunch of YouTube videos.
Uh-huh.
So I'm watching a lot of soccer highlights. There's a lot of soccer that's going on.
Mm-hmm.
And I have this really good skill of falling asleep while watching YouTube videos.
Yeah.
I've perfected that.
I think you perfected it.
I perfected it. Yeah.
Okay.
And I even, you know, have my AirPods.
Mm-hmm.
My AirPods, I have them just on one ear so that when I fall asleep, I fall asleep on the other ear that doesn't have the AirPod on it.
I've done that.
Yeah. So, you know, it's a pro tip is all I'm saying.
So you're just watching soccer highlights?
Mostly soccer highlights. I've been trying to avoid political stuff, but it's unavoidable.
Mm-hmm.
And what else? I haven't really had time to read. Very much. But been reading drafts of our book, which is coming out in spring 2025. Oh, my goodness. Yeah. So that's happening.
Okay. I should probably read that. I haven't been doing that.
That's right. Yeah. Shameless plug time.
Yeah.
Our book. And what is our book about, Maggie?
It's about proteins.
Yeah.
And that's a nice segue into our topic today, or one of our topics that we're interested in.
Absolutely. It is. Because
a few weeks ago, we're recording on Halloween, listeners, it's Halloween. So a few weeks ago, the Nobel Prize winners were announced. And one of them, the Nobel Prize in Chemistry, has to do with proteins.
Absolutely, yes.
And not only does it have to do with proteins, but AI, which is a favorite thing here.
That's right.
And the work that was done for this Nobel Prize is something that is actually your field of work in some way and some of your experience. So I thought today it would be fun if you kind of talk about the Nobel Prize, the winners, and the research and the work they won it for, and your own experience in this field of proteins. So I'll let you elaborate and talk about it a little bit more.
Well, let me tell you, the Nobel Prize in Chemistry this year, 2024, is just the coolest. It really is the coolest.
I was very excited.
And very well-deserved. It's basically kind of split in two.
Mm-hmm.
So even though three people won the Nobel Prize, they're actually shared. So two of them kind of got half of it for one part of the work. And the third person got half of the prize for the other part of the work. And both of them, you know, have to do with proteins. Proteins, of course, we love proteins on this show because proteins are kind of the engines of life. They really do almost everything in, not just in the human body, but in every living thing that's ever lived. So they digest the food, they move our muscles, they receive signals from the outside world, like taste and smell and sight and sounds. And they also send and receive signals within our body. So a lot of our hormones are proteins, like insulin, for example, is a protein. So really, they're kind of the worker bees of the cell. And for a long time, we knew that proteins are made up of amino acids. These are the building blocks. So these are chemicals that come together in long chains to form proteins. And so the analogy that's often used is beads on a string. So you can imagine that you have beads, and each bead represents an amino acid, which is a chemical entity. And then you have them all together in a string of beads. And as you can imagine, a string of beads can be quite flexible. And at each position, you can think of having a different color representing a different amino acid.
Mm-hmm.
And if you were to take a string of beads and put it in your hands, it's probably not going to stay in a linear form. It's probably going to fold up on itself.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, that's what proteins do as well. But the difference here is that if you were to toss these beads around, they would take on different forms or different three-dimensional structures. But proteins don't do that.
Mm-hmm.
for the most part, they take on these very specific, precise structures. And that's because they have a specific function. So insulin, for example, is made of a bunch of amino acids. And let's say like something like around 50 amino acids or so, right? Insulin. And it doesn't just like, it's not just a blob that's moving around. It has a very specific shape because it's recognized by the insulin receptors, which is another protein that has a shape. So they have to have this handshake. And obviously, if my hand didn't look like a hand, it would be a very difficult thing to do to shake hands with anybody else. So,
People
can do it without.
Yeah. But I understand your
metaphor. Okay. Yeah. Terrible analogy.
No, I get it.
There you go. But, yeah. but let's just say that if a chair looked like a printer or.
You wouldn't be inclined to sit on that.
You would not be inclined to sit on that. Right. So things have to have their right shape to have the right function, and proteins are no exception. And so for a long time, it was easy, and it has been very easy for us to figure out the sequence of the beads on that string. We can tell which color comes after which color, and that comes from the genetic information in every living thing. So the genes tell us the order of amino acids, for the most part, in every single protein that not just we make, but every living thing makes. And so with new technology for the last 20, 30, 40 years, DNA sequencing and, you know, it's become so commonplace that we can tell the sequence of amino acids for virtually anything that we can get our hands on.
But can you explain a little bit more about like what a DNA sequence, how we know that that goes to an amino acid? Because I don't know if people, maybe they don't remember their
High
school biology.
High school biology.
I don't remember lot of what I learned. So can you go back a step further even?
Right. So what DNA is kind of the genetic code. It is the genetic code for all living things. And we pass that along so that, and essentially our DNA is made up of a bunch of genes that are connected to each other. And in a kind of an oversimplified view of it, every gene, more or less, is the instruction for making proteins. And so it's kind of like the instruction manual. So when you buy a dresser from the store or something from IKEA and you have the instruction manual, you need that to put together the dresser. The dresser is the functional unit. That's where you're going to put your clothes in or, you know, whatever it is in it. You can't really use the instruction manual to put your clothes in it, but you absolutely need the instructional manual to build that functional unit. And so you can think of DNA as the instructions and the proteins as the functional unit, and they have to have that structure so that they can function properly. And so building proteins in any living system relies on being able to read the instructions in the DNA and then translate that, which is the actual term, translation, translate it from the language of from the language of DNA to the language of proteins, and building a functional protein that has a right three-dimensional structure that then allows it to function. So that a dresser is going to look different from a chair, which is going to look different from a telephone, which is going to look different from a 2x4, and so on and so forth. And each one has its own function within a living cell, just like each one of these things has a function in a household or in a factory or what have you. And so why was this Nobel Prize so important? Because even though it was fairly easy to figure out the sequence, the linear sequence of DNA, which then can give you an information about the linear sequence, meaning what comes after what, the linear sequence of proteins, that step, that next step of going from a sequence of amino acids to a functional structure was very, very difficult.
Right. So basically, we couldn't understand what parts we needed to make it, but we didn't know what it would look like when we made it.
Exactly. That's true. And in the same way that if I were to give you a string of beads and each bead has a different color, and I would tell you, can you tell me what shape it's going to take on if I just toss it? That's very difficult to do and very difficult to predict. And so there are ways to do it in the lab. They are very expensive and extensive, and they don't always work for every protein. So it involves fairly big facilities, and you have to treat proteins in a certain way. And the most common way is to shoot it with X-rays and then try to figure out what happened to the X-rays as they move through the protein. And from there, you can kind of figure out what the structure looks like. And even then, you don't always get the full picture. You don't always get an accurate structure, but you get a pretty good idea about what proteins look like. And if you've never looked, you've never seen what a protein looks like, look up alpha helix and see what that looks like, and look up beta sheets and see what those look like. And they have these beautiful structures that tend to kind of repeat, but in different combinations. Mm-hmm. And so we know some more basics about what proteins, the structures that proteins typically make on a small scale. And then as you combine those, you get more elaborate things. And so it's almost like having a Lego set. You have all these different colors, but you can really combine them in almost infinite ways. Mm-hmm. And that's why this problem has been so difficult, because it's literally called the combinatorial problem in a way. You know, that different sequences can give you different structures because of the different combinations that you can have. And it was very, very difficult to go from structure or from sequence to structure. There was no way to do it. It's not that there was no way to do it, but there's no straightforward, easy formula where I plug in the sequence and I get a structure and here it is. Now, why do we want to know the structure of proteins? Well, of course, proteins are the engines of life. They do almost everything in our cells, but they're also huge drug targets because we need to be able to turn them on or turn them off. And when diseases happen, oftentimes, it's because your protein is either not functioning properly or overactive, right? And for example, in some cancers, if a protein that is a growth factor is overactive, that means it's going to cause the cells to grow uncontrollably. That's a very simplistic way of thinking about it, but that's essentially what's happening, that the protein is just giving the cells the signals that they don't need right now. They don't know that they don't need it. And they're just growing uncontrollably. And so if we're able to figure out the structure, we can build molecules that can, you know, slow them down or fix the ones that are broken, in a sense.
Yeah. And another example, you know, we're talking about human diseases, but, you know, with bacteria, antibiotics, those are also targeting different proteins in bacteria that are involved in maybe their ability to make their cell walls, mm-hmm. or even their ability to metabolize things. So you're stopping their ability to grow.
Right.
So we aren't just curious about human proteins. We're curious about everybody's proteins.
Because everybody's proteins.
We want to know everybody's
cool
proteins.
Everybody's proteins are cool proteins.
Yeah.
We're studying proteins from viruses. We study proteins from, you know, I mean, it's really an open field.
Yeah.
So understanding proteins is really understanding one of the most fundamental forms of life, or the fundamental forces, mm-hmm. that drive our ability to thrive. Mm-hmm. Not just us. When I say our, I mm-hmm. mean like every living thing, yeah. You know? And so proteins are cool and they're amazing. They do, again, almost everything. They are the worker bees in the cell. And just having the instructions to build them doesn't really give us an idea about the structure until AI came into the picture. Mm-hmm. And that was, again, one half of the concept that was given, that was awarded the Nobel Prize in 2024, is how do we go from sequence to structure? And that's where AI kind of came in. And we've had a wonderful episode about AI, mm-hmm. with one of our favorite guests ever.
Yeah, Janelle Shane.
Janelle Shane, who was an expert, wrote the book on AI. Mm-hmm. Definitely go check it out. You Look Like a Thing and I Love You is the name of the book. Definitely check it out. And check out our episode.
Yeah.
With Janelle.
And we talked about it briefly with her, this Nobel Prize,
right.
And the machine learning and why AI is really good at solving this particular science problem.
Yes, that's true. In fact, one of the things that we talked about with Janelle is how AI has failed at a lot of things, mm-hmm. but this was one of the things that mm-hmm. it was really very good at.
Yeah.
And I think that this is something that, as a biochemist, as a protein scientist, has been so exciting.
Yeah.
And what's really nice about it, so it's just to give credit to the people who did this. So this was, DeepMind. DeepMind is an AI network that was designed by Google. And essentially, it's called AlphaFold. And now there's version AlphaFold 2, and I think there's AlphaFold 3 as well. And the idea is that you would basically just give it the sequence of the protein. You say, here's the first amino acid, here's the second amino acid, here's, and these proteins can be very long. They can mm-hmm. be, you know, hundreds of amino acids mm-hmm. long, or they can be very small, you know, a few, just a handful of amino acids. And what happened is that in 2020, this team led by Demis Hassabis and John Jumper, the two recipients of the prize, they enter this competition. And this competition is called the CASP competition, which is the Critical Assessment of Structure Prediction, right? We'll just
We're
call it.
We're really good at like lots of letters and...
Lots of letters and names.
Acronyms and stuff.
You know, it's... that sounds like a boring name, but we tend to name things for what they are, but mm-hmm. sometimes it sounds even more confusing than mm-hmm. it should. But this competition was basically has been held for many years, and the idea is that they give groups of scientists sequence of a protein. Nobody knows the structure of it, and at the same time, there are people in the lab who are working to get its structure. And then they compare the two. They mm-hmm. say, okay, were you able to figure out the structure from a sequence? And they give them a bunch of different proteins that have never been seen before, or things that, you know, where the structure has not been solved. That's the word that we usually use, because it is a problem to solve. And, you know, on a scale of from 0 to 100, and, you know, the scale is not necessarily accuracy, but it's a scale from 0 to 100 is kind of like how they're graded, mm-hmm. if you will, mm-hmm. right? To just be more accurate. The best ever performance was like 75.
Wow.
And like here and there, right? What this group did with AlphaFold is that they scored about 90% on average. So their average scored with 90, not their highest. This was their average, and it was 90%. So they came really, really close to perfection in terms of, you know, how a sequence of amino acids connected together like beads on a string folds into a three-dimensional structure, and how closely it resembles what the actual structure is, right? That's determined in the lab, by shooting it with x-rays or whatever it mm-hmm. is. And so that was a huge accomplishment, because this is what has been called the protein folding problem.
And we have a lot of problems.
We have a lot of problems in science, and it keeps us in business, which is really great. I mean, you know, bring me your problems and we will... Well, we'll find other problems also.
Yeah. We're not solving them.
We'll solve some
Except
things.
Except for this.
And this has really been amazing. And what's really nice about it, and I think this is a theme in this particular Nobel Prize, is their ability to share mm-hmm. this tool with everybody. So any one of us can go to AlphaFold 2. It's available as a Google Colab, which means that you can use the Google resources and put in the sequence of your favorite protein mm-hmm. and then hit enter. And then basically within, I don't know, 15, 20 minutes or so, or even less, mm-hmm. you're going to get a few reasonable structures.
Yeah, I did that just this weekend. I did that for my own research.
How cool is that?
Yeah, it was wild. And I got some cool information that hopefully I can use in my research, but it was super easy.
It is very easy. Yeah. It's very easy. And that, you know, for a long time, I just want to mention, as someone who has worked in computational protein structure or protein engineering, is that it's not really accessible. You really needed to be a programmer to be able to, you know, or you needed to be able to write code to be able to use these tools, because they were kind of clunky and very difficult and kind of esoteric in a sense, meaning mm-hmm. that you had to know the code. You had to know the commands, and it was very difficult for people who are trained in working in the lab, the wet lab, as we call it, mm-hmm. where you're just, you know, you're moving solutions around, you're, you know, you're working with the actual proteins, you know, purifying them and studying them and even shooting them with x-rays or whatever it is that you do. And going back and actually, you know, so kind of like bridging the gap between the programming side, the computer science part, and the biochemistry part, that was always very difficult. And there was almost a clear divide. Even in the same lab where people did this kind of work, there were the programmers mm-hmm. and then the biochemists, mm-hmm. and mm-hmm. they tried to talk to each other because they were trying to learn from each other. use each other's tools. And so this, in a sense, kind of democratized all of that,
mm-hmm.
made it fairly easy so that someone who is not a programmer or a coder can just go in and use this tool. And that's what's really awesome about it.
Yeah, you don't even have to be a scientist. If you just want to look up anything,
it's beautiful.
You can just,
yeah.
You don't even have to take the sequence. Mm-hmm. You can also just go and look through their database of existing structures that they've predicted or people have deposited or whatever.
Yeah.
So it's just AlphaFold.
It's wild.
It is so cool. It is something I will do just for fun.
And, you know, so how does it actually work? Well, you know, as when you go back and you listen to our episode with Janelle,
mm-hmm.
we know that that AI tries to model how we think as humans. Mm-hmm. And it's essentially about learning patterns.
Mm-hmm.
And what's cool about this is that we don't really know how proteins fold, but the computer has figured out these patterns that proteins make. And the way that they have done this is by training the neural networks, you know, all these computers mm-hmm. connected together as if they are neurons in a brain, mm-hmm. and teaching them based on the structures that are available now. And we have about 200,000 or so protein structures that are available, that are known, that have been determined in the lab. And they fed those structures, or close to that many structures, to the AI, you know, nodes essentially, or the neural network. And it was able to connect sequence to structure and be able to predict, because again, AI is generative. It mm-hmm. can generate things by learning. And so that's kind of the basic, you know, oversimplified mm-hmm. idea. And it really, I think it succeeded far more than anybody thought it would. And this is very recent stuff.
Yeah.
Right. So normally, Nobel Prize is not given very so quickly to something that happens. Usually people who win it have had a legacy for years and years and years yeah. and years doing this, or a breakthrough that then proved to be transformative. Right.
Their work was done decades before they were awarded. But this was not the case.
Not the case. These guys have been working on it since maybe 2017 or 2018. And definitely the breakthrough happened in 2020.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really cool to see that kind of process. And so that they basically had this learning set of the available proteins, 200,000. And by the way, we owe all of that. Again, this is the theme here, is the democratization of science, making science available to anybody. And that's where public funding comes in, because mm-hmm. it's our responsibility as scientists who receive our funds from the public to be able to share these things with the public. And we owe all of this to the protein data bank.
Yeah.
The protein data bank is one of the coolest things that you can imagine. Anybody can go to rcsb.org, rcsb.org, or just Google protein data bank.
Mm-hmm.
And basically, any structure that's ever been determined in the lab will be deposited in there, and will have a unique ID. And you can go in there and then click around in it and move it around in 3D mm-hmm. on mm-hmm. your computer screen, or on your iPad, or on mm-hmm. your phone, and see what it looks like. And they look super cool.
I just saw on Twitter this morning, or X, whatever, PDB. PDB will post, the protein database will post things online, like, this is the structure of the week. And today for Halloween, because yeah. this is when we're recording, they posted a structure that looks like a bat.
I saw that this yeah, morning. Yeah.
And it's from some... Uh-huh. like blood-sucking worm or something like that. Something very Halloween-esque.
How appropriate. Yeah.
You know, we talk about science and art and proteins and stuff, and I think mm-hmm. there's a lot of people that see the beauty in these structures, and even, you know, PDB is like, let's have fun with this. And, you know, a protein that looks like a bat.
That comes from blood-sucking something.
Some scary.
Something creepy.
Something creepy. So
wow,
yeah, you can follow PDB on Twitter if that's your thing.
And PDB Europe, I think, is the one that does it. Yeah, PDB Europe. Yeah.
So if you're on mm-hmm. that platform and you're just curious, mm-hmm. That's a great way to start exploring different structures.
No, proteins have these amazing structures that look like abstract art. Mm-hmm. And I think that that was one of the reasons why I became a biochemist, is because I saw these structures and they looked like, it looked like art. It really did. And it attracted me to them, and I wanted to learn more about them. And that's how I spent my entire career.
Well, we have a maybe slightly similar reason, because I was a biochemistry major. Yeah. So I am a biochemist at heart still, even though I'm a microbiologist now. Yeah, that's the one. That's the, you just pulled up the structure.
I just pulled up the structure, yeah.
But this is kind of related to this topic. I don't remember the number, but I was sitting in my biology 102 class, and we were like, we're going to just kind of talk about proteins. This is the number of potential structures that proteins could have.
With a certain sequence.
Or potential sequence, yeah. And it was some, and then here's the percentage we actually know. And I was like, I need to I need to study this.
And so actually you bring up a very good point here. But before I get to that, I just pulled up the structure.
Verify.
This is, it says Happy Halloween, because we're recording on Halloween.
Best holiday ever.
Yeah. Wow.
what does
this
it say?
The PDB ID is 8PDD. So if you want to look it up, it's 8P. DD.
Yeah.
You look up that PDB ID, and it looks kind of like a bat, and it is a protein from blood fluke, which is a parasitic worm.
I knew there was blood in there.
Yeah, blood fluke. It's a parasitic worm.
How fitting.
If you look up, if you follow PDB Europe on Instagram or any platform, you'll see it kind of, you'll see it rotating around.
Yeah.
And it looks kind of like a bat, which is pretty, and they colored it black is, you know, so.
Pretty cool.
So
I think, you know, AlphaFold and all these protein structures has let people have a lot of fun with science. And
absolutely.
So that's why I love it.
And to your point, you know, 200,000 proteins that we know the structure of right now seems like a big number, but it really is not. First of all, a lot of these are repeat structures. So it's the same protein, but under different conditions.
Mm-hmm.
So they're not unique proteins. Right. These are 200,000 structures, but they're not unique protein structures.
Right. So there's overlap.
There's a lot of structures of insulin, for example. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of structures of hemoglobin. There's a lot of structures of myoglobin. And some of them come from different organisms, for example. Like there's whale myoglobin on there, which is super cool. Right.
Mm-hmm.
And under different conditions, you know. So 200,000 is really not even a drop in an ocean, really, in the number of proteins. I mean, think about every protein that every organism that has ever lived, not just what is happening right now, every bacteria, every fungus, every plant, every parasite, every species that we have not discovered, they have their own proteins and they have their own structure.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just that what nature came up with.
Right, right.
Which is not the entire thing.
Not the entirety of the possibilities.
Not at all, because, you know, that, and that's, again, brings us back to that combinatorial problem, because if we go back to that analogy of beads on a string, there are 20 different amino acids to choose from. And so at every position, we can have one of 20 different colors, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
And then you go on to the next position, you say, okay, well, I can choose from 20 different colors. And then you go on to the next position, you say, I can choose from 20 different colors, and so on. And even if you have, so even if you have a protein that's just two amino acids long, the first position can be 20. The second position can be 20. The combinations is 20 times 20. There are 400 different proteins that you can make that are just two amino acids long, if you would even call that a protein.
Yeah.
Right? And if you add another one, you multiply by another 20. And if you add another one, you multiply by another 20. And so if you have a protein that's not very large, about 100 amino acids long, the combinations, the different combinations of sequences that you can make exceed the number of molecules or atoms in the universe. So obviously, I mean, this is insane. So obviously, all the proteins that can be made have not been made.
Mm-hmm.
So there's so much more to explore that nature has not even come close to exploring. Even with the amazing biodiversity that we have, there are poison dart frogs, and there are bananas, and there are chimpanzees,
blood flute parasite
worms, and dung beetles, and amazing diversity that we can't even imagine in a fictional world, but we have here in the real world. And even then, nature has only explored just such a small amount of the proteins that it can possibly explore. And that's the second part of the Nobel Prize.
Nice. Yeah, this is the fun part, I think.
This is the fun. This is really your work. Well, so
this is the type of research and work that you've done.
It's definitely my field, which is protein engineering. Can we take proteins from nature and change their sequence and make something that nature has never, ever seen before? So take a string of beads and change the colors a little bit and then see what new structures we get, what new function we get. Because nature... you know, nature is not trying to flex, right? Nature will only make proteins that it needs. And the proteins will work just as well, not as well as they can work, but just as well as they need to, and not any better or any worse. And so can we improve, it, for lack of a better word, I don't know if we can improve, but can we expand on nature? Can we expand on nature? We know that some proteins are called enzymes, and enzymes are our catalysts. They carry out chemical reactions. So they break bonds or form bonds. So, for example, we have enzymes that break down the food that we eat. They break down the bonds, and they use that to extract energy so that we can go and kick a soccer ball or, you know, whatever it is that we need to do. Important things, right? Mm-hmm. Soccer. And so, I mean, what else is there, right?
That's right. Soccer's life.
And that's why we eat. And food is amazing, too.
Food is amazing, too.
We like food on this podcast, and we like soccer, and we like proteins.
Yeah.
And dung beetles.
And now we like dung beetles, yes, thanks to our...
thanks to our guest.
Lee Haynes.
Yeah. If you have not listened to that show, that episode, definitely go and check it out.
Yeah.
You'll learn some amazing things about dung beetles and mosquitoes and weird bugs.
Yeah.
Anyway, so where were we?
Enzymes.
Enzymes are super cool. They are nature's catalysts. But, you know, you can imagine that they only carry out the reactions that are needed for life. But there are lots of reactions that we need, chemical reactions, either breaking down molecules. Let's say we want to break down environmental pollutants, right? We can do that in an industrial way. And that can be tedious. It can even create more waste. Or we can have a biological molecule do it.
I like that idea.
That's a great idea. Yeah. So can we re-engineer enzymes that nature gave us and turn them into something that can fix the mess that we've made, in a sense, right? Can we have enzymes that break down plastics? Can we have enzymes that... Not just breaking things down, but creating things. I mean, think about the drugs or the medicines that we have. Somebody has to create those in the lab. And to make drugs that are very precise and very clean, meaning they're pure, right? They're pure. They don't have any side reactions that are going to create some side, side product that's going to be harmful. Enzymes can be very, very precise in the way that they work, meaning that they will only make what they're supposed to make. And so tapping into that exquisite specificity, if you will, of how they work can help us make drugs in a cheap way, in an environmentally sustainable way, where we don't have to use harmful chemicals that we have to essentially dump down the drain, but also making things that are ultra pure and very precise in their function. Can we use them to make drugs? Can we use them to break down pollutants? So for that, we would have to re-engineer what nature already gave us. And that's what the second part of the Nobel Prize is about. And that went to David Baker at the University of Washington.
Well deserved.
Well, very well deserved. And I think a lot of people have been talking about him getting the Nobel Prize for a while because of his impact on the field. So David Baker created this computer program called Rosetta, referring to the Rosetta Stone, right, which helps translate things. And so a very cool name, translating protein structures into sequence and vice versa. So if you can think about the two different parts of this Nobel Prize in chemistry, one part is going from sequence to structure, and that's where AI stepped in. But what David Baker was mostly doing, he's doing a lot of things, but mostly doing is going from structure to sequence. We want a protein that has this new structure that we've never seen before, because with this new structure, it's going to have this new function. What amino acid sequence will give us that structure? Mm-hmm. And that's the idea here, is that one mostly went from structure, from sequence to structure, and the other part, it went from structure to sequence. Or I would even say from function to sequence. Mm-hmm. We want a protein that's going to do X, Y, and Z that nature has never seen before. What combination of amino acids can we hook up together to give us that sequence? How does that sound?
Sounds amazing.
It sounds amazing.
Sounds fun.
It's a lot of fun. And he started his career in the early 2000s at the University of Washington, designing some very small proteins, right? And he wasn't the only one. There was a bunch of other people, a very small group of researchers, because at the time, or maybe in the 80s and the 90s, when computers were becoming all the rage, as they say.
Is that what they said?
That's what they said.
I wouldn't know. You're older than me.
They were becoming all the rage, right? And everybody was going gaga over them. How about that? Is that still a thing?
Oh, I just thought of Lady Gaga, so well, I think we're, yeah.
Yeah, that I'm using different language now.
Yeah, I don't know what you're
talking about. Well, I'm talking about the
80s. I was not born in the 80s.
I was very young in the 80s. I was not doing protein engineering work in the 80s, but people who were doing protein engineering, again, the two fields were very separate. There were computational biologists, and there was field or lab biologists, mm-hmm. and they didn't really talk very much. And it wasn't until the late 90s, more or less, again, I'm generalizing here, that you would start to find these labs that combined the two, where you had programmers who understood biology and biologists who were able to talk to computers. And one of them was David Baker. And there was a bunch of other, you know, other labs. And people recognized early on the importance of this type of work, mm-hmm. because of just the power of computers and how quickly they were becoming more and more powerful to be able to solve these very, very big problems. Again, you know, just how do you take a sequence and make it fold into this structure? Or how do you design something from scratch where the combinations are astronomical, beyond astronomical, in fact, beyond astronomical? And so he was able to, in his lab, to design like these smaller proteins, protein structures, saying, can we design things that look like X, Y, or Z? And then using Rosetta and other things, his lab was able to make those proteins in the computer. So you can look at them in the computer and say, oh, okay, this looks great. But then building something in a computer and then actually having it work in the lab are two very different things. Mm-hmm. And in his lab, like the you know, handful of other labs, they were able to also bridge that gap, go in and say, what does the computer say? Well, it's suggesting these designs. Can we take those and build them in the lab and test them and say, do they actually look and function the way that the computer had predicted based on what the instructions that we gave to the mm-hmm, computer? Mm-hmm. So, you know, and then they go in and refine it more and more and more. And then in 2008, that was kind of a big breakthrough for David Baker's lab, because they published two papers on the design of enzymes. And again, this was a huge, huge accomplishment, because enzymes do all kinds of amazing things. They catalyze reactions, meaning they either break or form bonds. And what was cool about these two enzymes is that they were able to do the so-called non-natural reactions. So this was not just like recapitulating an enzyme that we already have in nature. They were doing a different kind of reaction that you would have to use, you know, organic chemistry, like just, you know, you would do in the lab with lots of chemicals, harmful chemicals. They used a biological molecule to be able to do this kind of chemistry. And so, you know, and then just went on. And it's really about a legacy here of just consistently delivering on amazing challenges. So later, his group was able to design new kinds of fluorescent proteins. These are proteins that glow when you give them a certain, you know, shine like black light on them, and they'll grow in different colors. They were able to modulate, like to fine tune what color the glow of these proteins is, which is pretty amazing. And the inspiration here, of course, is from jellyfish, because jellyfish have this protein called green fluorescent protein, or GFP.
Again, and like the acronym.
Yeah. And it's super cool because it's a green fluorescent protein. If you shine ultraviolet light on green fluorescent protein from these jellyfish, they will glow green, which is pretty cool. And, you know, obviously very, very useful in biotechnology, because you can trace things just using this kind of fluorescence, this kind of light glowing. They were even able to play around with bioluminescence, which is slightly different, because with bioluminescence, you're using a chemical reaction to make light. So you don't need a source of light, but you need food, if you will, right? And that's more closer to what you see with fireflies or lightning bugs, depending on where you're from, right?
It's lightning bugs.
Okay, man.
We're in Indiana.
We're in the Rust Belt. So this is, what was it again?
Lightning bugs.
Lightning bugs, yeah, lightning bugs. Okay, so lightning bugs have an enzyme called luciferase. And basically, it takes a molecule, breaks it down. When it breaks it down, it channels that energy into producing light. Mm-hmm. And David Baker's group was able to work on some bioluminescent proteins as well. And then later on, they were able to make some proteins that can, very small proteins that can block the flu virus from infecting its victims. And they tested this on mice, and they were able to show that if the mice were given these proteins either one day before they were infected or even one day after they were infected, they were able to survive the flu with basically no symptoms, because they were blocking the ability of the virus to infect the mice cells. And then, of course, 2020 happened, 2019, 2020 happened, and, you know, COVID kind of took over everything. And his group again was able to make these proteins that were very potent against COVID infections. And, you know, they were able to show again in mice, at least, that if the mice were to get these proteins, they would be protected from COVID infections, because, again, they designed these proteins in such a way to be able to block that handshake or that interaction, that part of the virus that latches on to the surface of the lungs of the mouse.
Right. Wow. That's an impressive legacy of protein engineering.
This is just a small handful of examples of what Baker's lab has done. And what's really cool about it is, you know, his legacy extends because of his graduate students and researchers that worked in his lab have gone on to be able to do some amazing things as well. And so it's not just this individual,
right,
but also just having that group of people and being influential enough to actually, you know, send people out into the community. Mm-hmm. And this was kind of his philosophy, as far as we can tell, very early on, because the tool that he developed, Rosetta, was freely available from the beginning. So anybody could actually use it. And anyone could improve on it, because he was always looking into this kind of crowdsourcing where scientists can help other scientists develop something that is better. So you can tell really where the emphasis was and what the ultimate goal is to have a good tool to solve these problems regardless of who actually solves them. And that's, I think, very commendable.
Yeah, I think so. Every year with Nobel Prizes, there's always seems to be some controversy over who was excluded. Mm-hmm. Every year I feel like this conversation happens because there's people who are actually doing the work. There's the people who are kind of coming up with the ideas, but they're not actually carrying out the experiments. And this year was no different with this prize.
Right.
There was a little bit of controversy over people, a particular person who was left out of this. And I know you wanted to talk about that a little bit.
Right. So, you know, I'm going to actually use David Baker's words.
Yeah.
When he was, I heard an interview with him when he was being told that he got the Nobel Prize. You know, this was an interview and he credited two scientists, mm-hmm. Steve Mayo and Bill DeGrado. And he said, and I'm quoting him here, he says, "I always thought if I ever won the Nobel Prize, I would be sharing it with Steve Mayo and Bill DeGrado. And I'm sorry about that." And so this was kind of giving credit to two also pioneers in the field. And Steve Mayo in particular, mm-hmm. who has been a pioneer in many, many ways, he actually, as far as we can tell, he was really the first to produce an entirely computationally designed protein. So this was in 1997, took a protein that's called a zinc finger protein and stripped all of the amino acids away from it. We know what the structure looks like. Can we recapitulate that structure, but using completely different amino acids? So just different sequence, but have it fold into the same structure, and was able to do that. And the paper came out in 1997. And then later on in 2001, published a paper that he basically mentioned something called enzyme-like proteins, where he took a protein that doesn't really have any enzymatic function and then was able to make mutations to it, again, using computational algorithms. And now this protein became enzymatic, and it was kind of a very simple reaction, if you will. There is no such thing as a simple reaction. A reaction is very involved. And of course, as with all of these computationally protein engineered enzymes, they are always going to be slower than the naturally evolved ones. So this was no exception, but it was, you know, I think, in my opinion, was kind of a landmark. Mm-hmm. And this predates what David Baker did. And so in a sense, if we are talking about awarding pioneers, I would say Steve Mayo would definitely be a pioneer. And, you know, a very important point to note, he's at Caltech. He was the first Black professor at Caltech to earn tenure in the history of the school. And so really a pioneer for African-Americans in general, but also for protein engineers and scientists. So really an amazing scientist and someone who definitely deserves credit, who's gotten a lot of credit for what has happened. And again, got a nod from mm-hmm. David Baker. But if we're going to talk about kind of legacy and just the sheer volume and productivity, then really, hands down, it's David Baker. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, you could say there's some controversy there in terms of volume and influence. And I think this is, there would be two different things here. You know, are we talking about who did this first? And that's a difficult question to answer, because the Nobel Prize oftentimes makes it seem like here's this one person or these two people that really just had this eureka moment, and that's what we're rewarding them for. But that's not what happens. We're talking about something that has been transformative. And in some cases, some of these Nobel Prizes go to people who had no idea that what they did was really transformative. But later on, it became so amazing. And so not only is it not a eureka moment, but sometimes the people who are doing the work don't even realize how important the work that they have done is. In fact, we know this with like the discovery of green fluorescent protein, right? Yeah. One of the guys who was key in discovering it, it wasn't really a big deal when it happened, and he ended up losing his job. Mm-hmm. And then he was like a taxi driver for a while, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. So he's just like, I lost my funding. I'm mm-hmm. not going to be a scientist. I'm not going to find another job. And then when Nobel Prize came out, they invited him. They said, "Hey, come over. You were influential in this." Mm-hmm. And so there are all these examples. And I think, you know, do you give it to the person who did it first or the person who had the most influence? Is David Baker deserving of this? In my opinion, someone who's in the field, absolutely.
Yeah, I don't think any people are arguing with.
Nobody's that. Arguing with that. Yeah. And it's really nice of him to really give a nod to Steve Mayo, but also Bill DeGrotto at mm-hmm. University of California, San Francisco, who has also been a pioneer in this area. But there's also another aspect, I think, to the influence of the Baker Lab and what they've done. And this idea, again, going back to this idea of democratizing science and making things available, which is a theme in this Nobel Prize mm-hmm. for 2024 in chemistry, because you know, the AlphaFold, the AI tool, is available pretty much to everyone. There are some levels to it that are not available to everybody, and that's causing some, you know, some controversy, mm. of course. But the major tool is available, and anyone can access it. So access is really, really important. And with David Baker, again, making Rosetta available to anybody very early on and having it, you know, basically kind of essentially open source. And on top of that, this idea of using, you know, like citizen scientists and crowdsourcing science. One of the things that David Baker's lab did very early on, they developed this tool called Rosetta at Home. Mm-hmm. And Rosetta at Home is pretty cool because what you could do is you could volunteer to have, you know, to have the lab kind of use your computer when you're not using it. Remember, these are very difficult problems to solve, and they take a massive amount of computational power. And what you have is stacks and stacks and stacks of processors, and they take a lot of energy. They produce a lot of heat. They create like facilities problems, right? If you've ever walked into like these computer facilities, they're just stacks and stacks of processors, and they're producing so much heat that they have to have like their own cooling areas. I mean, it's ridiculous, right? Mm-hmm. The amount of infrastructure, because you're thinking, oh, well, you know, I have a computer, I have a phone that has, you know, so what's the big deal? But when you really do it on that scale and you have hundreds of processors, it's pretty taxing. And of course, we always want more and more and more and more. And so the people in Baker's lab developed this tool called Rosetta at Home. You say, you know, I'm not using my computer 24/7. I only use it to check my AOL email or Hotmail or whatever it is. I mean, this was kind of mid 2000s.
Yeah, great time.
Great time, right? Yeah. And they said, okay, well, you know, would you let us use your processor? Because your computer has a processor. Can we just have it help us solve these problems of how a protein will fold or how it's going to take a structure? And you could actually watch it on a screensaver do its calculations. And
oh, I didn't know.
Yeah, so you could actually just say, you know, I'm not using my computer, I'm just going to watch the whole thing happen. And that was pretty successful because they were able to tap into hundreds or maybe tens of thousands, probably, of, I don't know the exact number, but you know, thousands of new processors that are remote, and it's essentially crowdsourcing your calculations, which is super cool, mm-hmm. right? And not only was it a great idea, but it led to even more discoveries, and some of them were published. And I think the biggest discovery that it led to was how people reacted to it. People who are non-scientists, and this, I think, is my favorite part of the story, mm-hmm. is that when people were watching this on their screen, they would track how the algorithm, you know, the algorithm doesn't know what a protein is, right? It's just, this is a computer. It doesn't even know what a protein is, right? And it can't really see what the people are seeing. And, you know, as they were seeing it, they would say, you know, this algorithm is really struggling with something. I wish I could just go in there and just like help it get over this little, you know, this little kind of bump. Mm-hmm. And I think it would look much better. Even though I, as the user, don't know anything about proteins, I know what looks right and what doesn't look right. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they were getting all these requests, you know, I wish I could go in there and just, it's like, tweak it, help mm-hmm. it out. And so they developed this new tool. It's actually a game called Fold It, and anybody can access this. It's fold.it. Fold.it. You can go to fold.it, Fold It, and you can basically play a video game. And the video game, you can compete as an individual, or you can compete as a group. And in fact, it can basically help figure out, you know, the missing part of, you know, kind of protein structures, right? If we have an idea about what the structure looks like because somebody determined in the lab, but there are parts that are missing because our data are just not really great. It's almost like when you take a picture of someone, but they're moving their arm too fast and it's blurred or it's too dark. Just the quality is not great. Can you have people help with figuring out what the missing pieces are? And this is all done with energetics, right? Mm-hmm. You can imagine if there are two parts, you know, if you have the beads on the string, two beads cannot occupy the same place at the same time. They're going to bump into each other and push each other away. And so you try to, you know, maneuver your way around so you can get the most favorable structure. And you get points for it. And of course, you know, people play these games. And so you have people who know nothing about proteins, are learning about it and really diving into it and feeling like they are part of this project. And in fact, they were able to develop their own algorithms. So they would actually, they call them recipes, that groups would come up with these algorithms. They're like, I think if we did this first, then did that second. So move things, but then shake things, but then, you know, see what happens here, or wiggle this a little bit, but then do this, then you can get better. And in fact, those recipes in some cases, which are really algorithms, were better than what the scientists actually developed, because the scientists were really not, you know, they were kind of like in their own mind in a sense, right? And in fact, they were able to publish a paper and have the authors on there be the players of the game. So talk about citizen science.
Yeah, yeah, that's so cool. I remember messing around with it a little bit.
Yeah? I actually have not played it. I've seen it. I've seen like videos of it. I've not played it. So what was your experience?
Oh, I don't remember.
Yeah.
I think I was like, I'm not good at video
games. Not good at video games.
So I abandoned it.
Yeah.
But I remember sitting around. Mm-hmm. I remember. It was cool.
Yeah.
So, congratulations to all those people who are now authors of a paper.
Yeah, right. That's exactly.
No small feat.
Yeah. So this was developed back in like 2008, 2009, I think, somewhere around there, right? And in fact, the users started making protein art. And that's really cool because they were like, you know, this little protein here looks super cool. What if we like repeat it a few times and see if it can like kind of bind together into like a cool looking bundle or a flower or, you know, and then they were able to make shapes that nature has not seen before. Mm-hmm. And then the scientists could take those and test them in the lab. Mm-hmm. And a lot of them were actually as predicted, which is super cool too.
Yeah, that's super cool.
And that's another part that, you know, Baker's lab has worked on, which is making new protein structures. So things that nature, again, has not seen before. And the application here would be like biomaterials. So can you make a material that's based entirely on proteins? These are going to be like nanomaterials because proteins work on the nanostructure, you know, 10 to the minus 9th of a, you know, like, and so that's another direction that they were able to do to expanding on the natural repertoire of protein function, but also, you know, making new enzymes, new proteins that can block infections of influenza or COVID, but also new biomaterials altogether.
That's impressive. And you have dabbled in a little bit of protein engineering.
Yes.
I worked on a project with you on, we were working on some biomaterial stuff, some nanostructures. I don't think that ever panned out.
No.
But I remember.
You could say we're still working on it.
Because there's stuff in the freezer that I could pull out at any time if I wanted to work on it. But you also do a lot of biosensors, designing biosensors
right
from proteins.
Yeah.
So
yeah. Yeah, and so that's another application for protein engineering is, can we use proteins to detect things that in a very, very sensitive way and a very specific way? So sensitive meaning how little would be there and you still pick it out, right? So, but also specific meaning it's not going to be fooled by something else that's similar to it. And, you know, biosensor design, as the name implies, biosensor, because it's a sensor that's based on a biological molecule. Proteins, because of how complex they are in terms of their shape, they can really, when they grab onto something, when they bind to something, they bind to it in a very, very, very specific way. You know, again, it's kind of like a handshake with your right hand, shaking hands with another right hand. It feels very natural. But trying to shake hands with the right hand and the left hand is awkward as hell. It's really weird. You should try it. And so this idea of handedness, that there is, you know, there is a, by the way, there are right-handed and left-handed molecules, right? We call them that for lack of a better term, but they are mirror images and they're not identical the way that your right hand and your left hand are. And so proteins have this exquisite ability to recognize things the way your right hand recognizes a right glove, but not a left glove, and the way your right shoe will fit perfectly into, you know, your right foot will fit into your right shoe and not vice versa. Although my kids, when they were younger, they always tried to break that rule.
Sure.
Yeah. It worked somehow. I don't know. It was
wrong. You give shoes. Up as a parent.
You give up. You're like, at least you got shoes on. I don't care. Right. Yeah, out the door. But basically. But
proteins don't do that.
Proteins don't do that, and because they have a very specific handedness, and it's really weird. All proteins are left-handed. We still don't know why. Almost entirely, all proteins are because the amino acids that they start out with are all left-handed. But sugars, the carbohydrates that are in biology, are almost entirely right-handed. And again, we don't know why there's this natural bias. But that aside, the fact that they have this handedness, meaning that they recognize things very specifically. And so one of the things that we've done in our lab is build these, you know, take a protein from bacteria and redesign it somehow so they can bind to environmental pollutants. So something like, you know, the molecule, the active ingredient in Roundup, for example, we were able to publish a paper on that together, in fact, in 2020. And what's cool about it is when the protein binds to or grabs on to this molecule and detects it, then it sends a little bit of a light signal so that we can detect that in a device that can detect light. And so that's a huge application, again, for protein engineering. Can we take proteins that naturally occur, modify them a little bit so that they can bind to, you know, molecule that's in Roundup, for example, it's called glyphosate. This is a man-made molecule, person-made molecule, human-made.
There you go.
Yeah, that's, there you
that's
go.
Good. Although I think a man probably made. Yeah.
Who knows? Glyphosate. I mean, I probably took credit for it.
There you go.
And it's not anything that nature has seen in the last, you know, except in the last 50, 60 years ago when it was mass produced. And so you can find the protein that binds to glucose, for example. You can find the protein that binds to DNA. You can find the protein that binds, because there are all these natural things that are around. So proteins learned over time that it's good to bind to them and do things to them. It's good to grab onto glucose or sugars and bring them inside the cell. But for Roundup, you know, the active ingredient glyphosate, there's no use for it, not just yet. And so can we make these molecules that will detect it, but also can we make proteins that will break down things? And that's where enzyme design comes in.
Very cool.
I think everybody should be a protein scientist.
Yeah, I'm sorry, I'm no longer a protein scientist.
Well, but I mean, you can't really study bacteria without studying the proteins that.
That's true.
Yeah.
The proteins. Yeah, you do end up studying proteins in almost any field because they're the things doing, if you're studying a disease, the proteins are the thing involved. Bacteria, they do, you know, everything revolves around proteins. So.
And bacteria are super cool.
Yeah, I know. Bacteria.
We love bacteria on this show.
Yeah. Just going to keep talking about all the things we love. Which is really a long list in the world of science.
A long list, but it comes down to like proteins, bacteria, and food.
Yeah. Specifically bread.
Bread. Yes. We should have an entire episode just on bread.
We should get somebody who like, is there a bread scientist? I don't know.
I'm sure there is.
Yeah.
If there isn't, I'll volunteer.
Okay.
Yeah.
Perfect.
It's like, oh, test this. Did you say taste it?
Yeah.
Yeah, I'll taste it. No, I said test it. No, I'll taste it.
Yeah. People who work with yeast, research yeast, they are like, yeah, the lab smells like bread
all the time.
All the time. Like, man,
yeah.
That's got to be better than what I'm smelling.
That would mess with my head, though.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, you smell bacteria all the time. I work with bacteria as well because that's how we produce our proteins.
Yeah.
We coax bacteria into making our proteins for us, right? Instead of actually literally putting each amino acid together, we just say, here's the instructions, the DNA, make it for us. So we grow the bacteria and then we cruelly bust them open and kill them. So there's no, I'm not a Buddhist, so it's, I don't have a problem murdering a few billion bacteria to get what I want.
I don't have a problem with it, but I do think about it when I'm doing it.
Really?
Yeah.
You think about like, they're like, no. Ugh.
I mean, the worst, one of the ways you bust them open is you just shoot them with really loud sound.
I know. Yeah. Yeah.
And that's a little bit jarring to be like,
yeah.
All right.
So you give them the sound waves that will literally turn them inside out.
Yeah, called sonicating.
Sonicating. Yeah. We'd use that too.
I don't care for it.
Yeah.
For many reasons. But every time I do that, I am like, I'm just.
Are you imagining yourself being killed by sound?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I feel like I'm going to be killed by the sound in my house.
Yeah, I know. I'm thinking noise. Like I haven't died from the noises that my kids make yet.
But even like going to a loud concert or something, your whole body is like vibrating.
Yeah,
I don't care for that.
Some people like that.
Yeah. To each their own. Whatever floats your boat. You know?
They're nuts.
I'm not gonna yuck anyone's yum.
Okay, all right, fine.
I do think about it when I'm killing bacteria. I'm like, sorry, guys.
Yeah, sorry. You got to do this for science.
Yeah.
I'm doing this for science.
Yeah.
Okay.
All right.
Yeah.
Well, thank you, Shahir, for sharing about the Nobel Prize. We were both very, very excited when we...
We were very excited about it.
Heard David Baker won. So anything else you want to add?
Well, I just want to say that, it's easy for us to talk about all the cool things that happened in the field of protein engineering and give credit to the people who have really put their minds and their hearts into it, and also the support from the public, whether it's through funding or playing these video games. Mm-hmm. But, there's always kind of an alternative side, a different side to the story. And there, as many as there are success stories, there are stories of failure. And I think it's important for our audience to understand that there were other people working on these problems. And, some of them, obviously a lot of them did not really make it. Mm-hmm. And others kind of went down in flames for various reasons, and there's just some crazy stories.
There are some crazy
when it comes to protein engineering.
Yeah,
and maybe we can save that for part two.
Yeah,
I think
that would be fine.
I think so. So this will be part one, and then we'll have part two on when things go crazy in science.
Yeah, and it fits nicely into this Nobel Prize. Somebody who is a good scientist gets the recognition. That's always what we want. So,
yeah. So,
congratulations, David Baker. I'm sure you're listening to this podcast.
I'm sure you're listening to the podcast, and we would love to have you on.
Yeah.
Just so,
listeners, go check out AlphaFold, PDB.Europe on social media platforms if you want to see some cool protein structures and learn a little bit more about this as well. So,
and fold it.
And fold it.
Yes.
Yeah.
Definitely play some games for the good of protein engineering.
Yeah. All right. Thank you so much, Shahir.
Thank you, Maggie. At the end of our show, we would like to thank you, our lovely listeners, and our awesome audience for spending your time with us. We thank the Notre Dame College of Science and the Indiana University South Bend College of Arts and Sciences. Special thanks to the wonderful people at the Notre Dame Studios. Coming to you from beautiful South Bend, Indiana, in the heart of the Rust Belt, this is Rust Belt Science. I'm Shahir Risk.
And I'm Maggie Fink.
And we'll catch you next time.